These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. These lectures are titled, Books That Have Made History, Books That Can Change Your Life, Part 3. Lecture 25, Plato, Republic.
In this lecture, we continue our discussion of the theme of duty and responsibility, and especially the duty and responsibility of a citizen. In our earlier lectures, we have looked at the Aeneid of Virgil. We have studied the two great wartime orations by two great democratic statesmen, Pericles and Abraham Lincoln. And we have examined what has been called, and I believe rightly, the greatest war novel ever written, the greatest war novel ever written, All Quiet on the Western Front, by Eric Maria Remarque. And in the course of that, I have posed to you the question, is it the noblest thing that you can do to die for your country? Now, guiding us through the discussion of all of these great books, I believe should be the model of Socrates, one of the greatest teachers ever. And Socrates always insisted that you go back and define your terms. How can you know what you're talking about unless you define those terms? So last hour we defined the term education. How do we know what education is, and what is the education of a citizen? So how do we decide what we really mean by the nobility of dying for your country? Because if you're going to go out and die for your country, the thoughtful person will have examined this. And to do that, we want to continue with our discussions, building upon our discussion of Confucius, his Analects, of the Prince of Machiavelli, and going today into the Republic of Plato, going this lecture into the Republic of Plato, and then in our next lecture into the wonderful work on liberty by John Stuart Mill. What then is nobility? How do we go about defining it? And Socrates, through Plato, would say it is about justice, and it is about defining the concept of justice. And justice is part of a series, as we shall learn further in the Republic, a series of essential qualities or virtues that every individual should have. We met them already in Socrates' discussion of the immortality of the soul in the Phaedo. And I have suggested to you that we find them across a number of cultures, including classical India, the Bhagavad Gita, as well as Confucius. Wisdom, justice, courage, and moderation. Now, courage is certainly essential to those who go out into war. However, what is the difference between courage exercised in a just cause, in a just war, and courage exercised in an unjust war? You see, without the wisdom to understand that your nation is fighting for justice, courage can be nothing more than brutality. Certainly the soldiers in the Waffen-SS on the Eastern Front were brave men, but they were fighting for an evil cause. And wisdom would have allowed them to understand that cause was evil, and true courage would have been to say, no, this is wrong, I'm not going to do it. And that all must be linked together by moderation. Any quality, even courage, if pushed too far, becomes unwisdom. It can be unjust. So it is the working together of all of these elements, courage, moderation, and wisdom, that produces true justice. That is the theme of Plato in one of the greatest books ever composed and one of the most thoughtful essays in What is a Good State? The Republic of Plato, composed probably in the 380s BC. Plato was the pupil of Socrates. We encountered him in the Phaedo. Socrates, as you know, and as I've told you, never wrote a book. But Plato paid him the greatest of compliments by putting all of his ideas, Plato's ideas, into the mouth of Socrates, as though to say, without Socrates, none of this would have existed. Now, Socrates was a true philosopher. He was a true lover of wisdom. And as we saw in our lecture upon Confucius, when we compared Socrates and Confucius, both of those lived their ideas. They lived their wisdom. Plato, though we, of course, call him a philosopher today, is really an intellectual. Because I want to distinguish between the philosopher, which would include Jesus, who lives his ideas, and the intellectual who talks about them and may from time to time try to put them into action. And Plato did do that. He went to Sicily and tried to help educate the tyrant Dionysius. It was a total failure. And Plato is, of course, one more of those who, if you can do, if you can't teach. What he then did, and was his great contribution outside of his magnificent works, was to create in Athens a university where lectures were held and young people were trained. And it was through this university that Socrates was institutionalized. Socrates' ideas by themselves were very revolutionary, very dangerous, got him executed. They needed to be put into a proper perspective, and Plato did that. He institutionalized them, taught them through the university, and lived to a ripe old age. He was not, like Socrates, put to death for his ideas. In fact, it's very interesting. Socrates dies like a philosopher. Plato is absent from the last days of Socrates because he's sick. And Aristotle, who is the true professor, when the Athenians think about putting him to death for his ideas, he goes into exile. And he gives the wonderful rationale he cannot allow Athens to sin twice against philosophy. But Plato is the most profound mind of the European world. And it has been rightly said that all of philosophy is a series of footnotes to Plato. This is what the English educator Alfred North Whitehead quite rightly said. And the greatest of Plato's works is The Republic. It is a true great book. Like Dante's Divine Comedy, it is very difficult. Like Dante's Divine Comedy, it summarizes the values of a civilization at its apex. And that civilization is the world of the city-state, of the polis of classical Greece. And its concern with how to create a constitution that would ensure justice for all citizens. Plato puts this discussion, as he always does, into the form of dialogues. And among his other great qualities, Plato is one of the most brilliant writers ever to compose. He has a gift of dialogue, of gathering you along in the discussion, that would do credit to any novelist. So he creates a scene in which Socrates, who is always the central figure in these dialogues, is coming back from a religious festival. A religious festival to the goddess Artemis. A new festival that has been introduced for this goddess of the wildlife and fertility. And of course, by the way, it points out to you how deeply religious Socrates really is. Remember, he's put to death for blasphemy, for not believing in the gods of Athens. But in fact, he's always at religious festivals. Like Confucius, he has a deep respect for the traditional religious rites. He just wants them understood in the proper fashion. And he is coming back and is urged to go to the house of Cephalus, an elderly man about Socrates' age, they were contemporaries, and just to spend the evening having a meal and discussing, and he always likes to go see Cephalus. Cephalus is a man who is aging gracefully. Socrates says, you know, I noticed how much he had aged since I saw him last, but he still had that sense of composure and calm. And I said to him, you know, it is just wonderful that you take your aging so well. He said, yes, I do. And Socrates says, is there anything you miss in life? No, not really. In fact, you know that old Sophocles, the poet, whom Socrates had very little respect for, came up to me and said, how are you still doing in the service of Aphrodite? And I said to him, Cephalus, oh, the gods be praised, those ideas are long away from my mind. Now I just want to think and be quiet. And Socrates says, well, what do you think about? He says, well, as I reach the end of my days, of course, I keep coming back to the idea of, is there an afterlife? Do I have an immortal soul? And I know, Socrates, you believe that. But then what will happen to that immortal soul? Will there be consequences? Will I be rewarded for my just deeds? And will I be punished for my unjust deeds? I'd like to think that I am a man of justice and that I have lived my life as much as I could with a sense of justice. Well, Socrates says, you know, that's wonderful. You're pondering justice in your last years. What is justice? Have you ever thought about it? Well, I don't know. Here's a man spending his last years pondering justice. Well, he's never really thought about it. Socrates says, well, let's think about what justice is. And Cephalus says, well, I always go with what the poets say. Well, Socrates says, that's a good start, to go with what the poets say, like Homer. They are a source of much information for us, and many people take them very seriously. And the poets say that justice lies in doing what is good to your friends and punishing your enemies. In other words, rewarding your friends and punishing your enemies. Wouldn't you think that's a reasonable idea of justice? Pay back time for those who've done bad things to you and, you know, rewards for those who have helped you. A good politician would say that, don't you think? I would think President Nixon, for example, would define that as an idea of justice. And he was a president with many, many good qualities. So justice is rewarding your friends and punishing your enemies. And that was the standard conventional definition of justice. That is how Socrates, in the dialogues of Plato, so frequently likes to begin, with an idea that everybody accepts. And he goes on and begins to discuss. Well, how could a just man do unjust things, even to his enemies? Wouldn't the doing of an unjust thing to an enemy take away from his justice? And suddenly one of the guests interrupts. And he's a professor. Thrasymachus is his name. And he is a sophist. They were the product of this Athenian democracy of the 5th century B.C., this age of freedom, of prosperity, in which intellectuals came from all over the Greek world to Athens. Same way that intellectuals and academics come from all over the world today to America, because they make good salaries. And in Athens, they can teach at very high salaries. I've mentioned to you before, it is worth remembering, to study under a good professor, a good sophist, cost about as much in translated into today's currency as to do a degree at Harvard. A year under a sophist was about the same as a year at Harvard. It cost you around $40,000. That's what you would pay for your son, and your son would learn to speak well. That was the practical skill in the Athenian assembly. But in order to teach that young person to speak well, of course you needed to teach them to argue either side of a case. Because it might be expedient in one political setting to argue for, let us say, a war against Sparta, and in another political setting, when the tide of public opinion had changed, to argue against it, don't you see? And so you needed to not only be able to argue both sides, but you can't argue a side convincingly unless you believe in it. So you needed to teach that young person that there are no absolute truths. Nothing is absolutely true. It is just what is expedient at the moment. And that is why Socrates was so totally different from the sophist. In the first place, he never took any money. And in the second, he based his whole life upon absolute truths. But Thrasymachus, the professor, breaks in, and you can almost hear him snorting the way a whole professorial crowd does when you present an idea that's contrary to their current wisdom. Students are very respectful. They will listen. They are open-minded. Professors never. They already know all the truth, and Thrasymachus just snorts. All of this is a lot of nonsense, talking about justice. Justice is one thing, simply. It is power. Might makes right. Exactly what Machiavelli told us in an earlier lecture. Justice is just exactly that thing that the powerful can get away with. And laws are what the powerful put in place to serve their own interest. So there is no such thing as justice. Now, this is a very widely spread idea in Athens. In fact, during the Great War with Sparta, Athenian foreign policy had rested upon this belief that might makes right. In the year 416 BC, the Athenians had gone to the small neutral island of Milos, as we saw in our lecture on famous Greeks, demanded that this neutral island join their coalition, and when that island refused, the Athenians launched a preemptive attack upon Milos, captured it, put every male citizen to death, and sold the women and children into slavery. That nation, that free nation, disappeared from history. And In their justification, the Athenians said simply, we have the power. You can either join us, Melians, and live, or resist us and die. And when the Melians, the citizens of the island of Melos, appealed to the idea of justice, the Athenians snorted. There is no such a thing as justice. The gods don't care anything about humans. You let us worry about the consequences. You just decide whether you're going to live or die. So this very widespread idea that there is no such thing as justice, it is simply might makes right. Well, Socrates tries to argue patiently with the professor, and anyone who has tried to argue facts and reason with the professor knows how difficult that is, but Socrates is in a good humor, and never minds drinking a little bit, so he's mellow, and he goes through and tries to get Thrasymachus, the sophist, to understand that, you know, if justice is nothing but what the strong can do, and that they can do anything they want to the weaker, well, if they do unjust acts to them, those unjust acts will make the weaker people hate them. Well, so what? Well, sooner or later, if you make enough people hate you, since they outnumber you considerably, they will overthrow you. So why would you go around consciously trying to make those who outnumber you and in their collective mass will have more power than you if they cooperate and get together, hate you? So surely it is in the interest, since you're such a big fan of expediency, for even those with power to act justly. Well, you don't know what you're talking about, Socrates. You're just always coming up with these ideas. You're just like a lawyer. Well, all right, but let's just go along. All right, I'll just sit here and listen to you because you can't be right. Well, of course, he is right, but Professor can't admit he was ever wrong. So Socrates then goes on and said, but we have raised this question, haven't we, of what is justice? And how are we going to go about defining justice? And you know what I think we should do? Instead of just worrying about the individual, this one person, maybe we will come to a clearer understanding if we look at justice as a whole inside a big unit, such as the polis, such as the state. State is a word that I will use, but it is a difficult word to use in terms of the world of 5th century Athens. State, as I understand it, first is used in Machiavelli, il Stato, to mean a political unit separate from the people. And that's how we refer to it today. The government did this, the government gave me that. The government is taxing me. But for the ancient Athenians, as a true democracy, they were the government. And hence all of their official documents read, the Athenians. The citizens of Athenians passed this law, passed that law. So we should not separate the idea of government from the people. So how do we see the idea of justice in this great community that is our city, our nation of Athens, the polis? And in the Greek, Plato's work is called the politeia, which is the things, the way, the constitution of the city, of the polis. So we should turn and try to see what justice is in the city as a whole. The same way that if we want to understand a painting, we don't look at one little spot, we would look at the whole of it. Now, the city is a collection of individuals. And if we go around and look at every individual, each one has certain qualities. And I believe, Socrates said, that these qualities all reflect absolute values. I'm sorry, Socrates says, that is what it always goes back to with me. It goes back to absolute goodness and absolute qualities. And my whole thinking and approach is based upon a belief in absolutes. And I believe that there is somewhere in heaven an absolute wisdom. There is an absolute courage. There is absolute moderation by which we measure all other reflections of justice, moderation, and wisdom, and courage. And that the working together of courage, justice, and moderation, and wisdom will create a true justice. When wisdom, moderation, and courage all work together in their proper spheres, then we will have justice. So that's our definition of justice. When courage, moderation, and wisdom all work together. But how are we going to bring about this proper blend that will make the polis just. Well, we must look at every individual citizen and realize that you have a great abundance of courage. You're a very brave soldier. In fact, you're so brave that your moderation frequently is forgotten, and you will rush into the very thick of battle, maybe even throw away your life. And that also means that maybe you're not wise all the time. But you're brave, and that's very useful. Now, he has a great deal of moderation. In fact, he almost never takes a stand for anything. So he's never going to come to real wisdom and never going to really live out his life. But that moderation is a sobering influence on you, don't you see? And, well, she there, she has wisdom. She has wisdom, but not the courage to put that wisdom into effect. She knows what is right, but she's not going to put it into effect. But that, too, is valuable to have that wisdom. What we want, then, is for every individual to be able to exercise intelligently their own unique absolute truth or value. But now, once again, this rests upon the fact that your courage is but a reflection of an absolute courage that exists and would exist even if everyone on earth denied its existence. Do you understand that? The same way, this is not coincidental, that 2 + 2 = 4. That is the absolute truth. And even if the whole world denies it, as they did in 1984, remember, in George Orwell, it is still true. So the whole world can say there is no such thing as justice, there is no such thing as absolute wisdom, but it is true. What we want, then, is to bring all of this together. And once we have a polis in which every individual is able intelligently to exercise in the service of the community, in the service of the polis, the service of the state, their characteristic virtue, then we will have a just polis, one that exists for the good of all. For that is fundamental. The state, the polis, exists to serve the people. But the people must be made to understand this and understand how the right kind of service is rendered. Well, how are you going to do that, Socrates, people being the way they are? Well, it is only through education. And the Republic then turns into one of the greatest treatises ever composed on education for a citizen. And Socrates believes that we must take each individual at the earliest possible age. And at one point he even says, you know, the only way you would ever truly bring this about is just have children. Get rid of all the grown-ups one way or another and just start with the children. So you'd have absolutely clean slates. Oh, I don't know, I ponder that when I see a eager class of second graders. I would rather lecture to second graders than to 11th graders. 11th graders are just impossible to reach. They've already been too absorbed into the world. But those eager little second graders, their little hands reaching up into the air, wanting to learn, start with them. And what we do is then look at the qualities of each one of those and educate them. Now, the bulk of people have as their best quality, if we can bring it out in them through the proper education, sobriety, moderation. They just want to work hard, take care of things, and they will form the real basis of our community. And they need to be educated, of course, so they read and write, but also, of course, to understand that that is a good thing to do, that they should not aspire to be soldiers. They should not aspire to be leaders. They should just aspire to do very good jobs at what they do, whether they are farmers or cobblers or merchants or any of these. And that is what their education should rest upon, a kind of vo-tech, where they, instead of feeling that they have failed in society, they feel that they have succeeded and are being fulfilled. But then there will be a certain number who are warriors at heart, who have that competitive drive, who will shed blood if they have to in a just cause. And they need to be our soldiers. And there needs to be a soldier class. And they too need to study poetry and gymnastics. What can make your soul more alive than to learn good, real poetry? These are they who laid down the splendor of their young lives beside the Eurymedon. By land and on swift sailing ships alike, they fought with their spears against the foremost of the bow-bearing Medes. They are no more, but they have left behind the fairest memorial to their valor. Isn't that a good poem to learn, yes or no? Of course. So, the poetry and music stirring martial music. We learned a song yesterday, didn't we? In the beauty of the lilies, Christ was born across the sea. There's a glory in his bosom that transfigures you and me. As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free. Isn't that a great song? Yes. So that's what they will learn. And gymnastics. They will train their body. They will not be the weak and out of shape, but they will be trained to be warriors. So they will receive a military education. And they will believe that this is their role in life. And they will not aspire to be political leaders, nor will they be sorry that they aren't shopkeepers. They will be happy in this. And by carrying out their appointed task for their community, they will be just in their soul. Because the quality they have best, justice, the quality they have best, courage, is being used with wisdom. And that will make them just people. But there are a few. There are a few who have the ability to lead. And they must be our guardians. They must be our guardians. And for them, the road is long and hard. Excuse me, Socrates, may I ask you something? Yes, because this will get the attention of later generations a whole lot. What about women? What role do they play? Well, women have the same abilities as men. They can undergo the same education. Oh, okay. You know, to make sure everybody gets the right quality of qualities. I think there should probably be a community of wives and husbands and community of property. Good, good, good. Well, now, could I please get on with what's really important? Yes, yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead. All right. Now, there will be a few who have the ability to lead, and they will go through a long and elaborate education. They will pass beyond gymnastics and music to ponder the deepest of questions. And essential to that education for leadership that only these few will receive is mathematics, the study of numbers and geometry. Why? Because these, as guardians, must always keep their eyes fixed on the absolute truth and justice. Their eyes will be turned up towards heaven, and they will constantly contemplate the good and the true and the just. They will contemplate God, who is the embodiment of the truth and the justice and the wisdom. And the numbers and the study of geometry, that is the way to this perfection. What did I tell you? 2 + 2 = 4. Understand that. That is the very nature of an abstraction. And there is somewhere the perfect triangle, of which every triangle on earth is but a reflection. Oh, this is a wonderful portrait that you have drawn for us. I am just speechless at the end of it. I just still come back to this question, though, of justice. And even if we do all of these things or don't do them, who cares? Who cares if we have a just state and everybody in it fulfills their place? Ah, Socrates says, you know, do you know the story of Ur? No. Ur from Pamphylia? Ur, who could be any man, how he was killed in battle, and 10 days later, when they got ready to burn his corpse, he was still alive. He had not decayed at all. And they said, what are you doing? He said, I'm alive, I'm not dead. Well, what have you been doing all this time? Because you sure look dead, even though you haven't been decomposing. I had this most extraordinary experience. My soul left my body, and I went up to heaven. And there the gods saw me, and they said, Ur, you must take this lesson back to the human race. And there I saw the afterlife. And I saw the souls that had been so evil on earth cast down into the deepest pit of punishment, and they would never be free. And I saw others who had done good things on life but made a few mistakes. And I saw a few who had done a good many bad things, but could be redeemed. And after 1,000 years, each paying their penalties, they came before the fates, and the lots were thrown out. And each one, with all the knowledge of their past life and what they had suffered and gained from it, could reach in and take a new life. And I still saw people, knowing everything that happens, wanting to be a tyrant. Even a tyrant who would live only for 5 years just to have that power. And I saw Odysseus, who had suffered so much, reaching and saying, I just want the life of an ordinary person without troubles. And then they drink from the river of forgetfulness and come back to earth where they live out their appointed life. So they made their choice. It was with free will that we then live out our lives. So with this statement, this belief in immortality of the soul as the foundation of everything, Socrates ends his brilliant treatment of the just city.